Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and New Hampshire School Administrators Association, representing school superintendents and administrators, championing the education of children in our state every day since 1941. In today's ever-changing world, public education matters, and so does its leaders. Online at nhsaa.org.
And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, in for Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. Trauma of domestic or intimate partner violence has a long reach. The person on the receiving end, if she survives, and it is more often than not a she, may never fully recover physically or psychologically. And children caught up in a violent situation, too, may suffer lasting scars. Today on the program, a look at domestic or intimate partner violence and the resources or lack thereof in New Hampshire to support those suffering at the hands of an abuser. And we want to hear from you. What's your experience with the state when it comes to domestic violence? What does the state do well? Where does it fall short? And what else is needed to make sure the Granite State supports those who are suffering? Our number is 1-800-892-6477, email exchange@nhpr.org, or post on our Facebook page. Just search for NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And here to share their expertise on this subject are Alyssa Dandria, reporter for the Concord Monitor, who reported the series Fighting Back, Confronting Domestic Violence in New Hampshire. Angelica Wilkerson, Assistant Project Coordinator for DOVE, the Domestic Violence Emergency Project. She trains attorneys to help victims of domestic violence on such issues as protective orders. Scott Hampton, Director of Ending the Violence. And Officer Laura Spaulding, Domestic Violence Officer with the Concord Police Department. Thank you all very much for being here today.
Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start the conversation by sort of defining what we're talking about when we talk about domestic violence. And I'll go to you first, Officer Spaulding. What do we mean when we say domestic violence?
We consider domestic violence to be a pattern of behavior where one person uses coercion, domination, fear over another person to basically control them.
Mm-hmm. And is there a significant difference between those two terms I used at the start of the show, domestic violence, intimate partner violence?
There's not. Most times that we're dealing with domestic violence, it is going to be an intimate partner violence, a relationship. Domestic violence does cover family members as well, persons in the household, if it's a mother, daughter, son, father.
Mm-hmm. And Scott, we were speaking a little bit before the show about terminology. I wanted to give you an opportunity to weigh in on this as well.
One of the difficulties I think we have in addressing domestic violence originates from our original coining of the term. When we say domestic violence, it makes it sound like we're focusing just on physical violence. The problem really is abuse. And the distinction that some of us make is that violence is what you do. Hitting, kicking, pushing, shoving, stabbing, shooting. Abuse is the intent and the impact. So it's possible for someone to be violent and not be abusive. For example, self-defense. It's also possible to be abusive without being physically violent, such mm-hmm. as psychological abuse and whatever. So if we stay focused on the intent and the impact, I think we can do a better job of thinking about the nature of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Intent and impact is what we ought to be focusing on. Okay. Another term or pair of words that I wanted to clarify at the outset is the difference between victim and survivor, because sometimes people use these interchangeably, and I'm wondering, Scott, do you have anything to add on the subject of victim versus survivor?
Well, in some cases, it's important for us to understand the severity of domestic violence. In New Hampshire, each year, out of all the homicides that occur in New Hampshire, 50% of them are domestic violence related. So you realize how bad it is. So in those cases, there is no survivor. And we need to understand that sometimes the problem is that bad. It's all about perspective. Some people who've gone through this don't want to be referred to as victims. Mm-hmm. They don't want to have that label. They want to feel more of a sense of empowerment, which is what's taken away from them in the process of abuse. So people have different preferences with that.
Mm-hmm. Alyssa.
Yeah, I would just add to what Scott was saying as well. I think whether it's victim or survivor, it's up to the individual who's gone through that experience. And some folks would prefer to be called a victim. Others would say that they're a survivor. I think also it depends sometimes where they're at in terms of their recovery process and how recent the offense or crimes were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Alyssa, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the series that you put together, Fighting Back. What prompted the series? What did you hope to show readers?
So in April of 2017, I published a series called Unsilenced on sexual assault survivors. And it was really through that work that my awareness was raised about domestic violence and a lot of the issues surrounding that. And I wanted the opportunity to explore that further. So a few months later, I really got started doing this series. I found that a lot of coverage in the state was of situations where we had a homicide or a murder-suicide, but we really weren't hearing a lot from the survivors who had left experiences and survived. And I wanted to learn more from them about what that journey was like and to also get a better understanding of once they left, how were their lives now changed? Were they really free and out of that experience, or was the abuse ongoing? And what that was like for them. And also through that, we wanted to explore what the state's response had been and also what state resources were available for folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, listeners, please do find a link to the Concord Monitor series by Alyssa D'Andrea at our website, nhpr.org. And also give us a call if you have questions or comments about domestic violence in New Hampshire, 1-800-892-6477. I'm curious about, what is often the first step of a domestic violence issue entering into the system? And maybe I can start with you, Officer Spaulding. I don't know if you are the most likely person or position that someone suffering from domestic abuse would encounter. Is that the case? Is police the first time that someone is encountered and enters the system?
A lot of times it is, yes. We'll get a call. Some cases, it'll be the first call that we've ever been there, and it's a horrific event. Some cases, it's just a verbal argument. But usually we get the call because of someone hearing it. It's usually not a victim that will call that in because of shame, secrecy, that type of thing. They hide it. So usually we'll get a call from a neighbor or someone just passing by, and we'll respond. And so the police are going to know, and that's how it goes into our system. And then I read the log every day, as Alyssa said in her story, so that way I can follow up with those victims.
The police log, meaning people who have encountered the police in the last 24
yes.
hours?
Yeah. Yep.
So how do you, as a police officer trained in this, sort of recognize the difference between a one-off thing that you know, is not going to be an ongoing issue and something that is or maybe has been an ongoing issue?
I have the luxury of being able to look at the history through their names and see if there's been other incidents. I can kind of keep a log of how many times we've been there, how many verbal arguments there have been, if the children were present, things that are raising red flags, and I can try to connect with them and say, hey, I'm concerned because of this.
And Angelica, does what Officer Spaulding says about this sort of jive with your experience as well?
Yeah, so I think that for many people, their first experience does involve law enforcement. A lot of the clients that I work with through the Dove Project never go to law enforcement with their problems. They take their concerns to a crisis center, whether that's from seeing flyers in bathrooms or through their medical provider. A lot of them will go to the crisis center to assess what's going on. Are they in danger? What can they do to keep themselves safe? And that's oftentimes what leads to protective orders.
Officer Spaulding.
Just to add, a lot of times when I do follow up with victims and talk to them on the phone, I give them that option. I say, hey, if you don't want to talk to us or tell me about it because of any reason, you can talk to the crisis center confidentially. They're not going to tell us anything that you don't want them to.
Mm-hmm. So going to the police, going to a crisis center, are those the two main avenues for people seeking help or relief?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Angelica, I wanted to ask you about a particular aspect of domestic violence, and that is stalking. Where does stalking fit into the umbrella of domestic violence?
Sure. So for a long time, stalking wasn't really focused as a distinct crime. It was just part of the domestic violence framework, and I think that it was a misconception that stalking was, you know, your person hiding in the bushes with binoculars. And the reality is that most people know their stalker, and that in an intimate partner relationship, there can be stalking while you're still together. And generally, that's the case, is that these stalking behaviors, you know, monitoring where you're going, monitoring who you're talking to, those types of behaviors generally begin fairly early on in a relationship. And they make leaving the relationship much more dangerous.
Something which is already dangerous, but
yeah,
stalking makes it even more dangerous.
So leaving is already dangerous, but for the majority of people that, for the majority of women that are murdered by an intimate partner, they were stalked first. And over 50% of women that were stalked first and then murdered actually reported that stalking behavior to law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments. 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk to Lori. Lori's giving us a call now. Hi, Lori. Thank you very much.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead. What, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. I just wanted to say that I was in a relationship and had two children, and I left the relationship, and he would stalk me. I lived on a piece of property with a chain-link fence all the way around it, and he would actually climb over the fence and pound on my door at 2 o'clock in the morning. I would go to work early in the morning, take my children to the babysitter, and be driving to go to work, and then all of a sudden headlights would come behind me and it would be him. I was so afraid all the time. I never knew when he was going to show up and harass me. He tried to take my children away from me. He tried to take them from school, and I was constantly in a state of fear. I finally got out of, the only reason why I got out of that relationship and it, the stalking ended, was because he died. So, you know, it's sad to think that your children's father has to die for you to be not afraid anymore.
Lori, thank you very much for the story, and I appreciate you being willing to share it with our listeners. I want to put your comments to Angelica, who knows a lot about this issue. What do you think, Angelica?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that I'm very sorry that you had that experience, and I'm glad that you are now in a place of safety. I think that one of the biggest challenges when somebody leaves an abusive relationship and then starts experiencing stalking is it is such a mental drain on emotional resources. So that constant fear, the unknown, I think that sometimes that can be more traumatic, you know, the compounding fear, than sometimes being within the relationship and just experiencing a physical assault.
Mm-hmm. Scott, you wanted to weigh in.
Yeah, and I think this really gets to the heart of a major problem with domestic violence, is that the perspective that the victim or survivor has is often very different from the perspective of the abuser. So we talk about her leaving this relationship. She's leaving the relationship, and we even say to people who are in danger, we say, if it's that bad, just leave. We've heard that thousands of times. Mm-hmm. The problem with that is that what we are literally telling her to do is don't go back home. Leave the house. Flee. The assumption for her to be safe is that if she leaves, he's not going to come after her. So while she thinks she's leaving the relationship, has a very different idea. You don't leave me. We promise till death do us part, or we'll be together forever. And so the reason that separation violence starts or gets worse than it was at home is that this is the ultimate slap in the abuser's face. How dare you leave me? You're mine. You know, we got married. We're supposed to be together. And then he will track her down. This is why that often women are much in much greater danger after they leave than when they stay. And just as one example, there was a woman who told me, she said, I would much rather stay with a man who hits me than leave a man who would kill me. And she knew. She knew that leaving was dangerous.
That sounds like something similar to what you reported, Alyssa, in your Concord Monitor series. Alyssa, can you talk a little bit about what we just heard about the threat of leaving and what it's like for people in the first few days after they finally find a way out?
Yeah, as Scott was saying, there's a strong misconception that if you leave, then you can just escape the situation and that's it. But for a lot of folks, leaving is really just the start of that journey. There's so much that follows that, particularly if children are involved and it is a marital situation, the family court process can be re-victimizing. That can be a tool for abusers to further victimize and terrorize the victim and to try to get them to return to the home.
Can you explain how? How would it be re-victimizing?
Sure. So victims are often forced to go back into court and to relive some of those experiences and to talk openly in a public setting about what they went through. Also, facing their abuser, some of them may not have done that for a period of time, and that may be the first time that they're face-to-face with that person. And also, I've heard from survivors who will say that during the court process, the abuser may use certain trigger words or say certain things that then remind them of past abuse and put them in a more vulnerable situation.
We got a comment from someone who wanted to remain anonymous. Pardon me, who says, I desperately needed to go to a shelter, but my local shelter would not accept my dog. Pardon me, who I loved greatly. My husband, along with abusing me, abused my dog, but I chose to sleep in my car to keep my dog safe. And let's go to the phones and talk to Sabrina. Thank you very much for calling, Sabrina. What's your question or comment? Sabrina, are you there? I think we may have lost Sabrina. Sorry about that. But let's talk to Anne in Concord. Anne, thank you very much for calling. What's your comment?
Hi. My question is along the lines of, what are the requirements for people who are mandatory reporters of child abuse and neglect when they hear about things that are threatening for children's safety? For instance, any type of physical violence that's happened in front of children. I have worked for the state and seen that many of these people who are mandatory reporters are not making these reports, and it's rather worrisome and frightening on my end to see the children being put into these situations that could have easily been at least addressed to some degree.
Okay, Anne, thank you very much for your question. Asking about requirements for professional reporting, who's the best person to answer this question? It seems like we're Scott, what do you think?
Well, I think there are a couple things about the mandatory reporting. New Hampshire is sort of an unusual state in that we do have a mandatory reporting law for child abuse and neglect, elder abuse and neglect, abuse of what we call incapacitated adults. What's unusual about New Hampshire is that if you look at the statute, it gives a list of people who are mandated reporters. So, say, counselors and pediatricians and so on. And the list goes on for a couple of lines. And at the end of the line, it says, or any other adult. You think, well, why not just say any adult? What happened was we just kept adding more and more names to it. So what happens in New Hampshire is that every single adult is a mandated reporter of abuse of people in what we consider vulnerable populations. That's not true in most other states. Usually it's just a professional who sees these people on a regular basis. So the good news in New Hampshire is that we have a value that says we think everyone's safety is so important that we want to deputize every single adult in the state to be our eyes and ears. So this goes back to our original question about, you know, who's the first responder. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, law enforcement often is that. But that's really the second responder, because police don't know to show up unless other people are noticing it. So I think one of the ways that we are going to address this problem most effectively is when everyone thinks that we have a seat at the table, whether it's we see a child that's being exposed to it or just that an adult victim is in danger, that we all step up, we all make the phone call. And get someone involved.
Mm-hmm. So we all have an obligation.
We all have a job, because if we don't all step up to the plate, there really won't be safety.
Officer Spaulding.
And only in the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years since officers have been trained on trauma and the effects of children being exposed to domestic violence, then we've now started reporting when there are children present. And we did not do that before. We weren't trained to do that before. We didn't even add the children's names to the case. So now they are added, and we do forward that to DCYF.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk to Mary in Windham. Mary, thanks very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I actually had my own story of experiencing abuse as a minor. I'm an adult now, but at the time I was about 12, 13, and my father was abusive. So I had called the police on quite a few occasions at the time, and generally speaking, I got quite a feeling of apathy from them because, and actually at one point, I was 13, and when my father hit me, I actually spit in his face, and I was arrested. And I was put through with a juvenile officer that saw that I was basically a good kid and let me go with like some community service, which I actually enjoyed. The times where I was hit not so bad, that's when I called, and the times where it was bad, I didn't, but then wanted to get in trouble. I just wanted to stop at the time. And I know for that, with my own experience talking to people who have undergone domestic violence, this is not an uncommon story. In fact, there's this really well famous study that police officers themselves are about 40% or like over 40, or at least 40% more likely to have domestic abuse within their families, as opposed to like a 10% within the average family.
Okay, so and just so we're clear, Mary, about how long ago did you experience it yourself?
About like 7 years ago.
7 years ago. Okay, so relatively recently. Thank you very much for your call, Mary. Really appreciate it. We'll put that to Officer Spaulding because she mentioned something about police having, a higher likelihood of having domestic violence within their own families. I don't know if this is something that you've heard about.
Yes.
It is.
Yes, absolutely true. Just to go back to her original concern with the reporting as a juvenile, it's very hard, the same as it is with a domestic violence situation. It's a he said, she said type thing. And when you go into a home and you have a child accusing a parent, it's very hard because the parent is the adult in the situation. And if they're claiming that they're disciplining the child, that's okay in New Hampshire to discipline your child. So it does make it very hard for us without some type of evidence. Go ahead.
Scott?
Yeah. One of the things that it brings to mind to me is when we began the conversation, we were talking about the difference between violence and abuse. This is one of those areas where it's really important, because one of the things that Mary mentioned was about she's been victimized, she gets arrested. And it's not uncommon for a domestic violence victim or survivor to actually use more acts of violence than the perpetrator does, but they're doing it in self-defense, or they're doing it to resist or get out from underneath the control of the abuser. So a police officer shows up at the call, and we've had some abusers who say, I lurched toward her to make her think that she was in danger so that she would flail to create a safe space, scratch me in the face, the police show up, I have the injuries on me, and so the police go, well, one person injured, other person must be the abuser. Mm-hmm. So victims are getting arrested for their acts of self-defense because we're focusing on the physical violence rather than the abuse. So officers often go through what's called a predominant aggressor training, which we also try to do with other professionals as well, which says, how do we determine who's posing the greater threat to the other person rather than who actually committed a particular act of violence?
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's all about sort of understanding the context, understanding the intent and the impact of the people involved.
Listeners, we're spending the hour today talking about domestic violence, domestic abuse, intimate partner violence, and we've got a lot more to talk about. We want you to be part of the conversation. When we come back, we'll talk more about victims' advocates, law enforcement, and the courts. Your stories are welcome. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Canoy. We'll be right back.
Civics 101 has done hundreds of shows about how the government works.
But we realized that we missed a step, something bigger.
All right, step right up, gentlemen. Don't miss your chance to commit treason.
Our nation, our government, is all built on paper and ink.
That's why we made a 6-part series on the founding documents, the pieces of paper that make us us, or rather, we. Subscribe or listen online at civics101podcast.org. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR.
Coming up tomorrow on the program, a conversation with Congresswoman Annie Custer. Lauren Chooljian will host the conversation with the Democrat who just started her fourth term representing New Hampshire's 2nd District. What questions do you have for Congresswoman Custer? We have a form where you can submit your questions on our website at nhpr.org/exchange. Right now we're talking about domestic and intimate partner violence, and we've got some knowledgeable people here sharing their experiences with how the Granite State supports those affected by it. We're also exploring areas that could use some improvement, and your insights are valuable. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. If email is going to be a more comfortable venue for you, just email exchange@nhpr.org. We're here with Alyssa Dandria, reporter for the Concord Monitor, who reported the series Fighting Back, Confronting Domestic Violence in New Hampshire. Angelica Wilkerson, assistant project coordinator for DOVE, the Domestic Violence Emergency Project. Officer Laura Spalding, domestic violence officer with the Concord PD. And Scott Hampton, director of Ending the Violence. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Let's spend some time talking about people who are in positions designed to help those suffering from domestic abuse. And we'll turn to you, Angelica. What is an advocate in this context, and where do they come in?
Okay, so there are many forms of being an advocate. You know, to one extent, law enforcement, they're providing advocacy. Attorneys are providing advocacy. But I think that what you're really talking about here are crisis center advocates. Mm-hmm. And in New Hampshire, we have 13 different crisis center agencies that serve survivors of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking. There are opportunities for people to go in, and they provide a wide range of services that are confidential. They can assist with housing, safety planning, connection to economic resources. So they really provide a holistic approach.
So at what point in a domestic abuse situation does someone encounter or make contact with the crisis center?
So it could happen at a number of different places. Somebody can self-initiate and go to a crisis center. And for anybody that wants to reach out to a crisis center or find the nearest one to them, there is a statewide confidential hotline. The number is 1-866-644-3574. Mm-hmm. And that is a 24-hour confidential hotline that will help you find a crisis center near you to assist you with whatever your needs may be. And another way that they may potentially come in contact with a survivor would be through law enforcement. We have protocols in place with law enforcement where if they respond to a domestic, there are lethality assessment protocols, and that may result in an advocate being called and speaking to a victim right there on scene.
Mm-hmm. And Officer Spalding, are police officers also referral points for crisis centers?
Yes. All of our officers we've been doing the lethality assessment program now since 2009, I want to say.
That sounds about right.
We've been, the longest in the state to do it. And all of our officers, anytime there's an intimate violence domestic situation, they're required to go over the lethality assessment form with the victim or survivor and ask them those questions. And we also got cell phones put into all of our cruisers so they could make that call right there from the house so the victim could talk to an advocate immediately.
Okay. Scott?
Yeah. The lethality assessment program is a particularly powerful tool. It actually comes from research that was done through Dr. Jackie Campbell down at Johns Hopkins in connection with the Maryland Coalition. And what they did was the research showed the most dangerous signs to look for. So they would ask the victim on scene, has he ever used a gun against you? Has he threatened to kill you? And there are a few questions that are particularly dangerous. And if she says yes to any of those, she gets screened and automatically a call is made to the crisis center. She doesn't have to talk to the advocate, but the invitation is there. And what we found is that when those connections are made, the rates of severe violence and lethality plummet tremendously. Just that initial connection, showing how important it is for all of us who are working in the community to be working together. It's a great program.
And Alyssa, in the course of your reporting in your series for the Concord Monitor, what did you discover about the importance of advocates in tackling this problem of domestic abuse?
Advocates play a critical role in domestic violence cases, sexual assault, stalking. They're really on the front lines there to connect victims and survivors with resources. And that includes a wide variety of things, as Angelica mentioned, in terms of trying to connect them with shelter, get them in a place where financially they can go out and be on their own. That may be to apply for jobs, access to social services, and it also includes support. So if a survivor has to go to a court appearance, that advocate can be there to accompany them, to help them with the legal process, which can really be very complex and intimidating, especially if that person hasn't been through it before.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that court part, the legal part, in just a little bit. But first, I want to give Sabrina another try. Would love to hear from you, Sabrina. Are you there?
Yes.
Excellent. What's your question or comment, Sabrina?
My question is regarding children and the legislation behind how they're protected in a situation like this. For example, if you were to call DCYF and report that you suspected abuse, they would look for evidence of abuse, but they're only going to be looking, they're not looking for evidence of psychological abuse or emotional abuse. They're going to look for something more tangible. And I have, my best friend has been divorced for 3 years, and she's still in the abusive cycle because her ex-husband stalks her and abuses their child emotionally. So I'd love to hear what the callers have to say about how we can do something legislatively to enforce things like supervised visitation or even request supervised visitation and things like that.
Let's put it to the panel as best as we can. Scott, your initial thoughts on Sabrina's comments.
That raises a multitude of issues with regard to the impact on kids. One of the first things I'm going to say is that there is a tremendous focus now on what are called adverse childhood experiences, or what we call ACEs. This was a project started by the CDC a number of years ago, where they were looking at the various things that happened to children and trying to quantify the effects. So what's it like for kids who have been abused themselves, or in a house where the parents have alcohol or drug problems, or that one parent's assaulting the other, and they quantify the effects that this has on children later in life. So when you're talking about the need for legislation, what legislators always want is the hard data that says there's a problem here, we're noticing the effect. So that work is underway. The other thing that you brought up very specifically, which is something we were getting to, is the whole idea about supervised visitation services. Mm. And for people who are unfamiliar with that, what a supervised visitation center does is it provides a safe forum or a safe place for a non-custodial parent to spend time with the children in a way that doesn't increase the danger to either the adult victim or the child. And unfortunately, we only have two or three of them in the entire state of New Hampshire now, but there are efforts underway to expand these so that we have centers available in each of the counties.
Mm-hmm. This is something that Alyssa, you reported on, and if you've never been to one of these places, they can be just ordinary buildings, but they could also have rooms with, you know, toys for young children to play with, a comfortable setting where they can interact with their parents who may not live with them anymore. And as you mentioned, Scott, we don't have too many, but Alyssa, as you've reported, we used to have more.
Yeah, there used to be far more visitation centers in the state, particularly as we look at Hillsborough County. There had been one in Nashua. There had been one in Manchester. A lot of those centers have faced financial challenges, and even the ones that are still operating, the Stafford County Visitation Center is fully run off of grants right now. Merrimack County, their county has stepped up and supported the financial operations of the center, but they're very costly to operate. And a lot of that goes to making sure that proper security measures are in place so that the custodial parent and the non-custodial parent have separate entrances. There's metal detectors and proper screening when they go in to ensure that the visit that happens with the child stays safe.
Mm-hmm. Usually it's a court that says, all right, if you're going to both be in your child's life, you got to use this place at least for a little while until we know that things are going to be safe outside of this place, right? Is that how it works?
Yes. In high-risk cases where lethality is a concern, this is sort of the last stop to see if this parent is able to have safe visits with the kids in a monitored setting. There is someone in the room that monitors, as well as having video feeds to another area so that we can make sure that those visits are happening in a safe place and that they're not re-traumatizing the child.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones and talk to Rebecca in Concord. Rebecca, thanks very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a comment. I grew up in the Concord School District, and when I was in eighth grade, I brought in a bloody T-shirt to my guidance counselor and told her that I was being abused by the person in my home who was my caretaker. And they called DCYF, and a woman came in to interview me at school, and they answered all of her questions honestly. And when we were finished with the interview, she told me that she would need to also interview me at my home. And so that weekend, she came to my home to interview me, only this time she interviewed me in front of my abuser. And she asked me all of the same questions. But being a young child, I had no idea that if I was honest that I would be protected, and I was terrified to be honest. And so I lied when I answered her questions, and she dropped case. And I went on to continue to be abused for the remainder of the time that I lived in that household. But I also started to defend myself. And when that happened, I was arrested for assault. And I was on probation for my high school years and bounced around group homes and hospitalized and put in YDSU. And every time it was because I was defending myself against my abuser, and I didn't have anyone to advocate for me or to make sure that I was safe. And I guess that's my comment. I just wanted to contribute my experience and say how important it is that we're addressing the shortcomings in the system that's put in place to protect people who are victims of abuse.
Well, Rebecca, very sorry that you had to go through such an experience, but we appreciate you taking the time to share your story with us. And some of what Rebecca was saying, Scott, reminds me of what you said earlier about, people arriving at a scene and trying to figure out who is the actual abuser here. And it seems like it didn't fall the way it should have with respect to Rebecca. But those were my thoughts, thinking about her story and what you said earlier.
Yeah, and her experience, unfortunately, is all too common. And one of the things... When fact finders, whether it's juries or responders, are trying to sort things out, is they want to judge someone's credibility. Well, what did Rebecca say? She said, well, I lied. Mm. Well, if you lie, you're not going to be taken seriously. And what we don't realize is that she didn't lie because she's a liar. She lied because it's a safety strategy. Mm-hmm. And entirely different conclusions. This is why it's so important that all of us become more educated about the dynamics of abuse.
Yeah, Officer Spaulding, according to Alyssa Dander's reporting here, sometimes they lie to you, but not because they want to be dishonest, perhaps because they're afraid.
Absolutely. The abuser has usually made them feel that they can't succeed without them. They can't succeed on their own. They have no self-esteem. They're afraid. And the basic human needs, shelter and food, are counting on that abuser to take care of them and house them and their children or whatever it may be. So they, of course, they're going to lie. They're going to say whatever he wants them to stay alive and to survive.
Mm-hmm. Angelica Wilkerson.
So through the Dove Project, we do a lot of training with volunteer attorneys to prepare them to represent victims of domestic violence and stalking at their protective order hearings. And we put a big focus on being a trauma-informed representative, a trauma-informed advocate. And that really ties in there, because to be trauma-informed, means to understand that when a person experiences trauma, they may not remember things in a linear fashion. So they may report to the police initially the series of events in the way that they're remembering them at that moment. But then over the course of the next few days, they may remember things slightly differently. It wasn't because when they initially made the report, they were lying. They were relying on the information that they had given their brain in that immediate situation.
Mm-hmm. Scott.
Yeah, there's we actually have a term for it. This whole area of not being able to report accurately, immediately, and consistently. There's a concept called critical incident amnesia. And what this means is that when you've been traumatized, everything's all garbled up, and it takes a couple of sleep cycles before things get organized and gelled so you can sort of accurately report. I remember the first training I went to, there was a police officer who went to a very serious event where there were guns involved, and he initially wrote his report and said, when I arrived at the scene, fortunately I did not need to draw my service revolver, apprehended the suspect without incident. He writes his report, goes home, gets a good night's sleep, comes back and says, wait a minute, I did draw my revolver, how did I not remember that? So he changed his report, said he drew his revolver, went home, got another night's sleep, came back the third day and says, wait a minute, I actually fired off 3 rounds. I'm glad I didn't kill anyone. So now the question is, which of the 1, 2, or 3 times was he lying? None of the above. His story is inconsistent, but his access to the information changed over time. And this is someone who has supports, training, is experienced. If law enforcement officers naturally have this difficulty, imagine how difficult it is for an untrained victim of domestic violence.
Let's go to the phones again and talk to Mike in Concord. Mike, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. My name is Mike Lewis. I'm a partner at the law firm Rathian & Pignatelli, and I'm a former homicide prosecutor. And prosecuted domestic violence-related homicides. And now, you know, I'm all over the courts and also studying the courts. And the question I have for the panelists, since courts come up so much, is whether they have looked at and studied whether our courts are sufficiently resourced and staffed to address some of the root cause or correlative factors involved in not being able to address and curb domestic violence. So, for instance, you know, imagine a family court system that can't resolve custody disputes in a timely fashion. Are you aware of whether those types of questions have been studied? You know, such that you'd be able to draw any conclusions regarding proper staffing in the courts, resources, and the failure to address domestic violence. That's the question.
Well, thanks very much, Mike. I appreciate your call. Angelica, what do you think? Are courts prepared to handle the what domestic violence survivors need?
I don't think that courts are the answer, you know, on their own. I think that the bigger issue is connecting people who are involved in the court system with other supports. I think that our court staff receives training on domestic violence and the nature of domestic violence, but we also have to remember that every case is extremely case specific. I think that when they, in 2014, created Joshua's Law, I think that was a big attempt of the court system for people that don't know, Joshua's Law established domestic violence as a specific crime, which resulted in people that are convicted of the domestic violence crime their names were being sent to a federal database to prohibit purchasing or possessing firearms. So I think that was a big step for courts in recognizing domestic violence not only as a social problem, but as a crime that warranted protection.
Alyssa, your thoughts on Mike's comments on the courts?
I think that the court systems are often overwhelmed. There's so many cases that come through that often survivors are waiting a significant amount of time for resolution. And I think also that while advocates do a fantastic job, they're also overwhelmed and there's not enough to be able to meet the demand and to be able to work with all of the survivors that need those resources.
Mm-hmm. Scott?
Yeah. one of the problems is that currently the courts are understaffed with judges, so they're scrambling around trying to cover the cases. But in terms of efforts that are underway to address domestic violence better, there are several projects currently happening. One of them we're doing through our Justice for Families grant out in Stratford County, where we're looking at revising the parenting plan so that there be two versions, not just the standard one, but an additional one that looks at the needs of vulnerable parents. Also revising the first appearance procedures where parents go in and they're just starting the process of changing custody. We're making that more sensitive to needs of victims. But there's also another project going on with the Battered Women's Justice Project that's working in conjunction with the New Hampshire Judicial Branch to look at the procedures that the courts and all of the other agencies, such as alternative dispute resolution, all the approaches they're using, and they're going to come up with a plan to make the kind of modifications that Mike brought up.
Mm-hmm. Lots more to talk about. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about children. We'll take more of your comments as well. Lots of people on the phones, lots of people sending emails. We appreciate your taking the time to participate in this really important conversation. Give us a call if you'd like to lend your voice to it. The number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, filling in today for Laura Kanoy, and we're talking about domestic and intimate partner violence. In this part of the program, we'll talk about a variety of things, and we'll take listener questions. We do want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments, we do have some time remaining. 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to the phones right away and talk to Mark in Salem. Mark, thanks very much for calling. What's your question or comment?
Yeah, hi. I had a situation where my wife was very emotionally and psychologically abusive to me for many years, and our marriage just started to fall apart. And as I started to want to separate out of that marriage, she got physically violent and just started causing trouble for me in my job and just in many aspects of my life. And so, you know, she would like, I think the last part was when she was just hitting me one day, I just grabbed her arms and restrained her, and she said, "Okay, now I've got your thumbprints on my arms. I'm calling the cops. You're going to jail." And the police showed up, and what they said was, "Well, you know, under the law, both of you could go to jail. Why don't you try marriage encounter, right, with Catholic Family Services?" And it was just not, I think, an adequate response. And as the officer left and said, "You know, you two just need to find help," you know, she said to me, "Next time you're going to prison, you've got a police record now."
So,
you know, it was a situation where she knew what she was doing. She was just going to flip it on me, and I just had to leave. I just left and never looked back.
Well, Mark, sorry that this happened to you, and thank you very much for sharing your comment. So, domestic abuse, it seems, knows no particular gender. Scott.
Yeah, it's. I remember a number of years ago, we were talking about the difference between men and women in situations, and there was an extreme statement that said, men's violence is always instrumental, women's violence is always self-defensive. And then we got phone calls and letters from people who are in same-sex relationships. Hmm. And they said, well, a little hard to blame the other gender because they're not here. So we had to increase our analysis, and what we look at, again, going back to predominant aggressor, who's posing the greater threat, who's causing the greater harm, who's in most fear. But the bottom line is that abuse is not okay, and no matter which direction it is. So a lot of what we need to be focusing on is, what does a healthy relationship look like? So to go in that direction, there's been discussion about how important it would be, or what a great opportunity it would be, to offer a mini course in junior high school or high school when kids are around 14, 15, 16 years old, and have them go through maybe 4 or 5 hours, healthy relationships, interpersonal boundaries, basic respect. And the suggestion that one of the judges came up with said, why don't we tie this into their ability to get a driver's license? Every kid would sign up for it. Everyone wants a driver's license. So we need to start this work early to say everyone needs to be treating people with respect.
Mm-hmm. Officer Spaulding, did you want to weigh in on this comment, on this subject?
Just on Mark's comments, yes, we certainly have women abusers out there, and men are more afraid or ashamed to report abuse by a woman. She was stepping it up. That's a common thing for an abuser, is if one thing doesn't work, if they start with verbal abuse and then emotional abuse, and that's no longer working, he's saying he's going to leave. She had to step it up somehow. Usually men are physically stronger than women, so women are going to use another way. They're going to manipulate by getting that person to hit them and leave a mark on them, and then they use that fear. Okay, now you're going to go to jail because you did this.
Mm-hmm. We have this emailed comment from Michael, who says, much of the focus on intimate partner abuse focuses on services for heterosexual victims of abuse. Given that both the CDC and the National Violence Against Women survey found that abuse occurs at higher rates within the LGBTQ communities, what unique challenges face the community members, and what LGBT-specific resources are available? Who might be best to answer this?
I can start off just by the first part of the question in terms of what are the unique challenges. When we talk to victims or survivors of heterosexual violence, one of the things they say is a barrier to my getting services is that people are going to blame me for the abuse. They're going to find something I did that upset the person or whatever. It's somehow I brought this on, or it's my fault for not leaving or whatever. When it comes to people in non-heterosexual relationships, what they will say is not only will people blame me for what's happening, they're going to shame me for who I am. So this is extra layer that says I'm not going to step forward because people don't think I'm worth saving. I'm not worth protecting. They think that I am wrong, not just that I did something wrong, making it that much more difficult. But the crisis centers are set up so that, again, they will work with women, men, and regardless of what the sexual orientation is. But not everyone knows that. The other thing I wanted to mention, too, about the one of the barriers that people have seeking services from the crisis centers is that sometimes they assume, I can't call them unless I'm willing to go to the shelter, and I'm not ready to leave, or I don't want to leave. And that's a misconception. You can call, talk on a hotline. You don't have to leave a name. So people can take whatever services they want. They don't have to sign up for everything.
Mm-hmm. They can call, establish a connection, maybe know the first name of the person on the other end, and maybe someday that'll come in handy.
Someday it'll come in handy, and it's always up to them what they want to do. The crisis center will never say, you need to get a restraining order. You need to leave this person. They follow what's called an empowerment model, meaning I'm going to back up whatever it is that you want to do in your life. And if you tell me you want to stay with this person, even if I think it's a really bad idea, I'm going to support your decision, but I'll help you do safety planning so that it'll work out the best for you.
Alyssa, I did want to touch on one thing in your reporting that we haven't touched on yet, which is that you reported on classes for people who have been convicted of abuse, who are sort of relearning how to be better in relationships and be better people and not do the horrible things that they were convicted of doing. Can you talk a little bit about those efforts, both as for the state or whoever it was holding the classes and for the mostly men who were participating?
Sure. So I attended a batterer's intervention class that Scott was facilitating out in Dover. And that was a really interesting experience just to learn about how those programs are structured, the emphasis on learning healthy relationships, also learning from the victim's perspective why they may respond in a certain way, and also learning about how to take responsibility in relationships as well. We felt it was really important to look at the batterer's intervention programs, which are often a part of the court referral process, although not always. I think that Scott can speak to this more as well, but we'll sometimes see judges referring anger management over batterer's intervention, and studies really show that batterer's intervention's the most appropriate course, as domestic violence is not an anger problem, it's an issue of control and coercion, and that's something that's best addressed through the batterer's intervention programs.
Mm-hmm. Because as you report, it's one thing to teach someone how to stay out of trouble and another thing entirely to teach them how to internalize what is meant to be taught in classes like that. Right, Scott?
Yeah. And I think Alyssa really hit on one of the major distinction. A lot of people think that a quote-unquote batterer is someone who's got this anger problem. Maybe he's drunk. They have these sort of stereotypic views of them. But it's not about anger. In fact, for people coming to my program saying they have an anger problem, I do a very quick screening with them. And I say, imagine you're back in court and you're going in for a review hearing and the judge is being nasty to you and you find yourself angry. How likely is it you're going to go up and hit the judge? And of course, they say, well, I wouldn't do that because I'd be in jail in 2 seconds and, you know, Officer so-and-so is going to come get me. And I say, oh, so when you need to use your anger management skills, you have all the ones you need, but you go back home and all of a sudden you don't have those skills. Hmm. So what they tell me is, when they're being most truthful, is anger is not my problem. Anger is one of the tools in my toolbox because I use it as a tactic of intimidation. Mm-hmm. So I can control my anger all I want, but the bottom line is that it's all about control.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to wrap up soon, but I wanted to give you a chance to talk about something that you may have seen in another state really quickly that you think would really work well in New Hampshire. This is open to anyone. I don't know, Angelica, could I start with you? Do you have anything on the top of your mind that might work? Something you've seen in another state that might be worthwhile trying here?
You know, I think that we do a pretty good job of networking with departments in other states to combat the problem. I can't think of any particular programs off the top of my head that would be more appropriate. Through the Bar Association, you know, we have the Dove Project, which is a program for volunteer lawyers to represent victims of domestic violence and stalking. There's also NHLA, who provide a variety of services for New Hampshire residents, and we have the Legal Advice and Referral Center, who also provide vital advice for victims.
Well, we have to leave it there. We could have spent many hours on this subject. I want to thank all our guests for being here today. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Remember, this conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. Also at our website, resources on domestic violence for anyone who is touched by it, including links to the National Domestic Violence Hotline and groups and initiatives like Women Against Abuse and the Trauma-Informed Legal Advocacy Project. You can learn more about our guests as well at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our public radio fellow is Ali Oshinsky, and our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.